You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Hi, good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the RSA. I'm Matthew Taylor, Chief Executive. I'm delighted to welcome you here today. Now, it's my great pleasure to welcome today's speaker, Jonathan Haidt. Jonathan is a social psychologist at the University of Virginia, a visiting professor of business ethics at the NYU Stern School of Business. His research examines the intuitive foundations of morality and how morality varies across cultures. In recent years, he's examined the moral cultures of liberals, conservatives, and libertarians. Jonathan is the author of the widely acclaimed influential The Happiness Hypothesis. I was just saying to Jonathan before we came in, a book that was very influential in encouraging me to put issues around human capability and human nature at the heart of the RSA's agenda. He joins us today to share some of his latest thinking from his new book, The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. I've been reading it all over the weekend. I've got 15 pages left to go, so I've just left a little bit for you to add today, Jonathan. The book has already received wide praise. The New York Times hailed it as a landmark contribution to humanity's understanding of itself. It's a piece of work that aligns very strongly, as I have suggested, with the core aims of the RSA. It sets out to start a conversation about integrating a better understanding of human nature, our sentiments, sociality and morality into the ways we debate and govern ourselves. So we're delighted to have you here today, Jonathan. And without further ado, can I ask you to join me in welcoming Jonathan Haidt.
Thank you so much. Well, thank you so much. It's such an honor to be here. I've seen many RSA videos in this strange-looking room, and now I'm actually here in this strange-looking room. But as Matthew said, yes, the purpose is to have a conversation about human nature. And that's what I'm here to talk to you today about, is an idea about human nature. I'm going to tell you the story of this idea in five acts. This is an idea which I cannot promise you is true. But I believe that it is, and I'm going to make the case that it is, and I'm going to show that if it is true, it's going to be one of, I think, the most important ideas of the next 10 years, an idea that will change the way we think about ourselves. It'll certainly change the way we think about religion. So what is this idea? It's actually a relatively simple idea from Charles Darwin. In The Descent of Man, Darwin spends a lot of time puzzling about human morality. He's got to, because if he's going to explain everything by natural selection and competition, he's got to explain why we are often so virtuous, cooperative, helpful. So he generates all kinds of clever reasons. Maybe reputation matters. We do good so that it redounds to our reputation. That gets us more partners. Lots of explanations. And one of the ones that he generates is one he's trying to figure out why we do so many things that seem to be good, not for ourselves, but for our groups. And he offers this explanation. He asks us to imagine a situation in which two groups of early humans are competing with each other. They're near each other. They're competing. And he says, if the one tribe included a great number of courageous, sympathetic, and faithful members who were always ready to aid and defend each other, this tribe would succeed better and conquer the other. And then he goes on to say that selfish and contentious people will not cohere, and without coherence, nothing can be effected. What Darwin is really suggesting here is that natural selection can occur at multiple levels at the same time. So here's the way to think about that. Here are a bunch of guys on a crew team, and like any group of guys, they're competing with each other. Only a few of them can make it into the lead boat. The worst rowers will get cut from the team. The best rowers will make it on, perhaps even to the Olympic team. Within the team, their interests are in many ways opposed, and it would sometimes behoove each individual to badmouth the other guys, maybe badmouth them to the coach, make them be the one who gets cut from the team. And ethnographies of crew teams do show that there is a bit of this going on. But at the same time that they're competing with each other within the boat, their boat is competing with other boats. And as long as you have competition across boats like that, well, these guys in the first boat are all in the same boat. And they can only win if they all pull together as a team. So this was Darwin's idea, that you can have competition at one level within a group in which selfishness may be rewarded. It may lead you to get ahead. But if there are several selfish people in that group, then that group is going to lose out to the other group. And in the long run, if there's some process of elimination, let's say this boat, everybody on it, let's say the losing 10 boats in a regatta get sunk and all the members are killed. So if we suppose that life is sort of like a crew race where everyone gets killed at the end if they're in the bottom portion, we can see how these traits for selfishness might not make it so much into the next generations. All right. Now, so that's Act 1. Darwin proposes this idea. Here's Act 2. For the next 100 years, scientists are quite comfortable saying, oh, well, animals have all these virtues. Animals, birds may restrain their breeding for the good of the group. Or they may not graze too much because that would lead to starvation for everyone else. And you often even get this awful phrase, for the good of the species. I still hear this phrase today, and it should really never be said when talking about evolution and animal behavior. Evolution doesn't care about the good of the species. So you get a lot of loose thinking, a lot of loose talk, really a lot of bad biology. And some people begin to get disgusted by this, and this leads to Act 3. And I mean literal disgust. Two very, very important books in our intellectual history, George Williams' Adaptation and Natural Selection and Richard Dawkins' Selfish Gene. Williams, in this book, describes how he was listening to a lecture by a termite specialist and how everything is explained by the good of the group, which for termites works. That makes sense. They're all siblings. But then he applies it to other species, and they die to make room for the next generation, which is just crazy talk from a Darwinian perspective of natural selection. And so Williams sets out, as he puts it, to purge biology of this kind of thinking. He says, yes, it is possible that evolution could create group-level adaptations for groups to succeed. But then he examines them carefully in lots of species, and he says, chapters 5 to 8 will be primarily a defense of the thesis that group-related adaptations do not, in fact, exist. They're possible in theory, but you don't find them in the natural world, he says. In a later essay, he writes, morality is an accidental capability produced in its boundless stupidity by a biological process that is normally opposed to the expression of such a capability. Richard Dawkins takes a similar view, basically building on Williams' ideas quite directly, giving us a very intuitive metaphor of the gene's eye perspective, and concluding, let us try to teach generosity and altruism because we are born selfish. All right. So that is Act 3. This naive group selectionism is purged. Anybody who suggests that a trait evolved for the good of the group is laughed at, shut down, not invited back to lectures or parties. And that opens up... Oh, I'm sorry. Let me first just show you to illustrate this visually. It is helpful to see this visually. The main argument against group selection is this. Suppose you have a trait evolving in which behaviors are cooperative, nice. Each of these elements, they can be bacteria, they can be gerbils, they can be people, whatever. Each element is programmed so that when it interacts with another, it cooperates, the two together generate resources by their cooperation, everybody grows, everybody gains. It sounds lovely. But what happens when a single one mutates to follow a more selfish strategy? Well, I'll show you this simulation. You'll see as the blues and greens interact, they gain points and they grow slowly. But when a green interacts with a blue, you'll see it gains points rapidly, it grows rapidly, while the blues shrink. And if you start with just a single green, it's able to exploit the blues, and in no time at all, it will reach a tipping point right around here, where now suddenly altruism, cooperation are gone from the species, and it's all selfish. So this was the main argument that Williams and Dawkins raised against group-level selection, the free rider problem. All right. With that idea vanquished, the idea of group selection vanquished, we enter Act 4, which you can think of as the atomic age. Atomic in the sense that social elements, social actors, are thought of as individual atoms that move around in space. And these individual atoms have very simple wants. They want more good stuff and less bad stuff. Often it's modeled as more money or whatever it is. So in evolutionary biology, you model selfish gene theory, you model individual actors as single units that move around, interact. Very good for the early computer age in the 60s. We're just beginning to get computer simulations. You can give very simple rules and simulate social behavior. In economics, this idea takes off, rational choice theory. This whole approach is very, very conducive to the Chicago School of Economics that posits individuals being self-interested. This theory then goes on to greatly influence, of course, Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher. So this was a period of great consilience among all the social sciences. that we're all in agreement that people are fundamentally individual, selfish actors, and we can model social behavior, including apparently altruistic behavior, as really forms of disguised selfishness. Even in my own field, social psychology, a field which is supposed to study social nature, we get research arguing that every apparent case of altruism must be explained either as nepotism, of course, kin selection is fine, or enlightened self-interest, reciprocal altruism means we can cooperate if we expect reverse cooperation, or if it's neither of those, then it must just be a mistake. Everybody was saying, well, of course we leave tips when we go to restaurants in foreign cities, but that's only because we evolved to live in small groups, you see, and when we are nice outside of our small group, it's really a mistake. Okay, so that is Act 4. Now, during this period, the science of religion takes off. The idea here is that, well, once we've established that groups are not real, groups are not evolutionary entities, everything must be explained by looking at individuals competing with individuals. And since religion is quite costly, religions always ask for sacrifices from their members. So, boy, how could that be adaptive to pay such high costs? Well, if that's the case, then there's really only one clear way forward, which is to say that religion is not an adaptation for either individuals or groups. Rather, what it is a parasitic meme complex. This was one of Dawkins' ideas in Selfish Gene, which he develops at greater length in The God Delusion. And the reason why this parasitic meme complex is so effective is that our minds are full of modules that evolve for other purposes, such as a gullible belief module. Just believe whatever people in your culture tell you to believe. So these parasitic memes exploit us, and they make us do things that are bad for us but good for the religion. So suicide bombing, for example. Obviously, there could be no gene for suicide bombing. It's rather bad for your evolutionary fitness. It even has spread through even some women who have been suicide bombers, even some women with children. So Dawkins' theory of parasitic memes works quite well for suicide bombing. This is a meme, a cultural element that is very good for Islam, at least when it's in certain historical situations where it's in very vigorous war with other groups, but very bad for the individual. And so there are variations on this approach, but this was the dominant approach for the last couple of decades. All right, now we're ready finally for Act 5. And this is where we are today. There was one lone crazy guy, at least that's the way he was seen. David Sloan Wilson wrote a really interesting book in 2002 called Darwin's Cathedral, in which he takes Emil Durkheim's perspective on religion. Durkheim, the great sociologist, defined religion as a unified system of beliefs and practices relative to sacred things, which unite into one single moral community called the church, all those who adhere to them. So if you take a Durkheimian approach to religion and you say its function is to bind groups together, to allow them to work together, create a moral community in which they can be effective and cooperative in ways that they could not be if they were separated. So he joins Durkheim and Darwin together and says, look, this fits like lock and key, Darwin's multi-level selection and Durkheim's groupish function of religion. So that's where the idea stood for a while, David Sloan Wilson arguing for it, most biologists saying, well, possible in theory, but, you know, no, in practice there are no group-related adaptations. But this year, this is a very exciting year. This is the year you guys have front row seats here on what I think is going to be a turning point in intellectual history around these ideas. My book was the first of three to come out, but The Social Conquest of Earth by Edward O. Wilson is coming out next month, and then Christopher Bohm, an anthropologist, has a book called Moral Origins. So with three books all coming out in the same year, arguing that basically Darwin was right, multi-level selection did shape humans, not that many other species, but it certainly, not certainly, we believe that it shaped humans. And the cool thing to me is that we all came to this from very different perspectives, but we're all trying to understand human nature and finding, you know what, this selfish individual approach isn't working. I can't explain most of morality. Wilson can't explain the origin of eusocial insects and other animals, and Bohm can't explain what happens in hunter-gatherer tribes and other groups that are selecting for certain virtues. So we all independently come to the same conclusion. So this is the year that the case of Wilson versus Dawkins is going to be tried, and you, ladies and gentlemen, are the jury. And the jury of public opinion, especially scientifically informed public opinion, I don't know how it works in the UK, but at least in America, juries are charged with one task, which is deciding questions of fact. And so it's a very simple fact. This is really what the debate boils down to. Were groups vehicles for human genes? That's the entire debate. Let me explain. A wonderful idea that we all got from Dawkins is the idea that the world is full of replicators. These replicators especially are DNA. There are other forms, but the most studied ones, the most important ones, are DNA molecules. How do DNA molecules copy themselves? By making animals and plants. So as Dawkins put it, a chicken is a chicken gene's way of making more chicken genes. Now this is a brilliant way to look at evolution, and it's one that I do not disagree with. I love it, actually. In fact, how many of you read The Selfish Gene? Raise your hand if you've read that book. Okay, so about half of you. I don't know if you had the same experience, but it was like the scales falling from my eyes when I read it in college. It was like, oh my God, you can see all this ornate complexity in the natural world from The Selfish Gene perspective. It really does work. Now let's try to run it through groups. Chickens don't live alone. They live in groups. So were flocks of chickens vehicles that carried chicken genes on to the next generation? Well, let's apply Darwin's test. If the one flock included a great number of courageous, sympathetic, and faithful chickens who were always ready to aid and defend each other, this flock would succeed better and conquer the other. Well, it's an empirical question. Do chicken flocks work this way? And the empirical answer is no, they do not. You don't see gangs of chickens flocking around, beating the hell out of other chickens and taking their coops. It just doesn't work that way. So chicken flocks are simply not vehicles for chicken genes. Okay, let's try it for people. Let's say this is a human gene. And a human gene replicates itself by making a human. But now let's think about this. Do human genes travel around to any extent in tribes, in groups of people that work together, that come together, and then compete with other tribes? And I submit that the answer is obviously yes. I'll just illustrate one of the ideas that I describe in Chapter 9 of my book is how we came to be so tribal. And this is a major transition in human evolutionary history. Our behavior is much like that of other primates until about 600,000 or 700,000 years ago. We domesticate fire, we get hearths, we get division of labor between the sexes, we get groups cooperating to hunt large game. So you get this big change, you get larger groups, and once you get that, of course you're going to get competition between groups for territory at very least. So here's the way that I visualize it. Imagine people coming together who are not necessarily kin. Hunter-gatherer groups turn out to actually have a lot of people from the area that are not exactly kin. And then they start erecting tribal barriers around themselves. Who's in? Who's out? And once you get humans living in tribes, and this appears to come in 120 to 90,000 years ago, we get signs of tribal markings and body paintings, things like that, in the archaeological record. So now imagine that human groups in Africa before the dispersion are all living in this way. And might it be the case that some tribes do it better than others because of cultural inventions for sure, but might it also be the case that certain genetic mutations make some people more tribal? Their minds are just better at making something sacred, circling around it, trusting each other, basically being fit for gang warfare, let us say. Obviously, there's also trade and cooperation among groups, but there has been competition for quite a long time. So I think when you look at it this way, it's rather obvious that human genes have come down to us not just because some people beat out their neighbors, but because some groups beat out other groups. Three very brief exhibits in this legal case. When Dawkins and Williams were purging biology of group selection, this was the age of Aquarius. That is, this was the 60s and 70s, an age when anthropologists told us that human nature was loving, peaceful, and egalitarian until evil private property came in, agriculture, and hierarchy. But war was unknown until we get private property and wealth. That turns out to be just radically false. And two books, Keeley's book in the 90s and recently Steve Pinker's book, make a very, very compelling case that as long as we've been groupish, we've been fighting each other, tens or hundreds of thousands of years, or well, many tens of thousands of years at least. So to some extent, the genes that come down to us in a kind of a football tournament. So you have groups competing, and sometimes groups wipe each other out. and so the genes that come down to us in the modern era. It's not that we're all Brazilian, necessarily. It's that some groups conquer other groups, defeat them, wipe them out. This wasn't all warfare. A lot of it was just starvation. Groups that could work together and preserve food and cooperate survived, whereas those that weren't as cohesive starved to death. Obviously, when a group beats out another group by warfare, they tend to take the young females. So it's not as though this is a perfect genetic lottery. There is some crossover. But the point is, the genes in this room today are not a random cross-section of the genes that were on this planet 100,000 years ago. They are the genes that managed to hitch a ride in successful tribes, successful groups. All right, exhibit B. If this is the case, if we did evolve by multi-level selection, then we would expect to find some groupish instincts, some things buried in the human mind, part of human nature, that makes us groupish. And this is what really got me into this study, that I study morality, and we do all these weird things that don't make any sense without group-level selection. So I'm going to just read you a short a page from my book that illustrates one of these. In the terrible days after the terrorist attacks of September 11th, 2001, I felt an urge so primitive I was embarrassed to admit it to my friends. I wanted to put an American flag decal on my car. The urge seemed to come out of nowhere, with no connection to anything I'd ever done. It was as if there was an ancient alarm box in the back of my brain with a sign on it that said, "In case of foreign attack, break glass and push button." I had an overwhelming sense of being an American. I wanted to do something, anything, to support my team. Like so many others, I gave blood and donated money to the Red Cross. I was more open and helpful to strangers, and I wanted to display my team membership by showing the flag in some way. But I was a professor, and professors don't do such things. Professors are liberal, globe-trotting universalists, reflexively wary of saying that their nation is better than any other nation. When you see an American flag on a car in a university parking lot such as mine, you can bet that the car belongs to a secretary or a blue-collar worker. After 3 days and a welter of feelings I'd never felt before, I found a solution to my dilemma. I put an American flag in one corner of my rear windshield, and I put the blue United Nations flag in the other corner. So that way, I could announce to the world that I love my country, but don't worry, folks, I don't place it above anybody else, and this was, after all, an attack on the whole world, sort of, right? Now, I believe that you can understand most of moral psychology by viewing it as a form of enlightened self-interest. And if it's self-interest, then it's easily explained by Darwinian natural selection working at the level of the individual. Genes are selfish. Selfish genes create people with various mental modules, and some of these mental modules make us strategically altruistic. Our righteous minds were shaped by kin selection plus reciprocal altruism. That's the message of nearly every book on the evolutionary origins of morality, and nothing I've said so far in the book to that point contradicts that message. But in part three of this book, I'm going to show why that portrait is incomplete. Yes, people are often selfish, and a great deal of our moral, political, and religious behavior can be understood as thinly veiled ways of pursuing self-interest. But it's also true that people are groupish. We love to join teams, clubs, leagues, and fraternities. We take on group identities and work shoulder to shoulder with strangers toward common goals so enthusiastically that it seems as if our minds were designed for teamwork. I don't think we can understand morality, politics, or religion until we have a good picture of human groupishness and its origins. So these are the kinds of instincts. We have all of these instincts. We don't show them very much in modern Western secular cultures, but they're there, and you can still see them. You can still see the angry response to people who betray your group. We can still see, I mean, just walk around London. My God, it's full of monuments to heroes. We designate battlefields and other significant lands as sacred. We won't allow development on them. So we do all these things that are hard to explain as adaptations that help one individual beat out the guy next to him or the woman next to him. They don't make any sense for that. But boy, do they work well if you think about groups competing with groups. All right, that's Exhibit B, and this has led me to formulate what I'm calling the hive psychology hypothesis. That is, that human nature is 90% chimp and 10% bee. Now, I don't mean that our ancient primate ancestors had sex with bees. What I mean is that human nature was shaped by the same forces that shaped all other primates, for being social, originally tree-dwelling primates. But in recent times, by recent I mean sometime in the last half million years, and especially the last 100,000 years, we were shaped by some level of group versus group competition, just as beehives are shaped by group versus group competition. And this gives us a kind of a hivish, groupish overlay that has not been appreciated by the social sciences or evolutionary biology. That's my big message today. This is the big new idea that I think is going to transform the way we think about human nature. We're 10% bee, and that has not been appreciated. We're very good at every man for himself. This is a tomato fight in Spain. And we're also very good at one for all for one. And we love it. We love doing one for all for one. All right, the last exhibit, Exhibit C. Religions do, in fact, solve free rider problems. And they do, in fact, help groups cohere. Religions ask a lot of people. Some sacrifices are relatively trivial. Here's a group of Amish women who can't fully enjoy a day at the beach because of the dress codes of their religion. Here is one of the most delicious foods on earth, banned to my ancestors because it is treif. It is not kosher. So these are relatively small sacrifices, you might say. But of course, religions demand much greater sacrifices as well. Self-flagellation. People put their lives at risk. They sometimes give their lives. Very, very costly sacrifices. How could that be? How could that be adaptive? Well, the best research on this comes, the most directly relevant possible research was done by an anthropologist, Richard Sosis. What Sosis did was he collected data, reports on 200 communes, that is intentional communities in America in the 19th century, groups that left the corrupt morals of the city, let's say, and tried to start their own community with good values that they wanted. And about half of them were secular, mostly socialist, half were religious. And what this graph shows, this is how long the communes lasted in years, and most of them were over within 10 years. Most of them faded away or broke up within 10 years. The black lines are the religious communities. The gray bars are the secular ones. The number here is the number of communes in that group. This group is the number of costly sacrifices that the commune demanded. So this tells us that 27 of the secular communes demanded between 0 and 2 sacrifices. These were not expensive communes to join. You didn't have to change yourself much to join. So 27 of the secular ones fell in this category, and on average they lasted 8 years. 20 of the secular communes asked for 3 to 5 sacrifices, but they also lasted about 7 or 8 years, and on and on. So the point is, most of the secular groups asked very little, but none of them lasted very long. The secular communes faded out very quickly. The black bars are the religious communes. Now here, for dramatic emphasis, I've blacked out most of the data, and here's the rest of the data. What this shows you is that there were 4 that asked very little, and like their secular counterparts, they died out very quickly. But there were 10 communes in his data set that demanded between 3 and 5 different kinds of sacrifice, and they lasted longer. And then these are the ones that demanded 6 to 8, 9 to 11, and more than 11. And what you see is a linear effect so nearly perfect that you rarely see this in the social sciences. For religious communities, the more they demand of you, the more effective the moral community is at maintaining itself and lasting 60 years, on average, 65 years. Quite a feat. So the take-home message from this, I think, is that gods are like maypoles. I myself am an atheist. I do not believe that there are gods in the world, but gods are very, very common human inventions. Are they just parasitic meme complexes that spread because they help themselves while hurting us? I don't think so. I think that gods are like maypoles, that is, they are human inventions that then enable people to circle around. And when we circle around something with other people, we then trust them and we create a moral community with them. This is just so obvious when you look at religious practice. It so often involves literally circling around something. Here's the Kaaba, a rock in Mecca, the center of the Muslim universe. But if you've been to, you know, so in America we've got Burning Man, this giant festival, this gigantic man burned in effigy, and then everybody, it just feels like the right thing to do. You circle around it. I imagine you must have some folk rituals here that involve this kind of circling. It's just something that we do. So, to close, let me just summarize. I began with Darwin's puzzle, human morality. Why are we so virtuous in so many ways? Darwin's puzzle and the answer he gave, and then the purge, the fact that his answer was rejected. What I'd like to propose is that going forward, we are now in Act 6, the future. I'd like to replace the Williams quote with this. Morality and religiosity are adaptations produced by a biological process, multi-level selection, that always yields a balance of cooperative and competitive impulses. And let's replace the Dawkins quote with this. Let us embrace a realistic picture of human nature and then maximize the benefits of our hivishness while minimizing its negative externalities. Perhaps not an inspiring word to end on, but I hope the idea is to some extent uplifting and hopeful. Thank you.
Jonathan, thanks so much for that and for the book. And I hope you'll excuse me, but I'm going to refer to the book as a whole, not just the things that you said today and indeed to your earlier work. So as a sociologist, I was, of course, delighted that in the book you, as a someone who's interested in psychology, have discovered in the end that sociology is, in fact,
essential,
the truly greatest social science. One of the interesting ideas in sociology in the last few decades has been the notion of reflexivity. So the idea that one of the things that is distinctive about modern human beings is this capacity to reflect upon themselves and reflect upon their own lives. Now, you introduced in the happiness hypothesis the idea of the rider and the elephant, which I adapted to be a rider and elephant in a jungle, the jungle being social norms, but you refer to that as well.
Yes.
Do you think, in line with sociological thinking, that our reflexivity, and indeed a reflexivity which also includes an understanding of our cognitive frailties, may in time change the balance between the rider and the elephant?
Absolutely. So I'm coming to you from what I think is the first reflexively designed nation on Earth, in which the founding fathers of the United States looked at England and took many great things from you, and others we said no thank you. It was very much a self-conscious effort in how should we govern ourselves. And the genius of the American founding fathers was that they really were aware of human frailty. They were wary of democracy. They saw that you had to have some sort of popular control, but they knew that when you open up to mass democracy, the people tend to vote for lower taxes and more services. America began an experiment in thinking about human nature and then trying to design institutions. And this is a big part of modernity. As we understand ourselves better, we're able to replace the sort of the natural institutions with some artificial institutions, some of which bomb terribly, and that's what the French Revolution was all about. Others work brilliantly, and I think the Scottish Enlightenment and then the American experiment were examples of how it can be done in a better way.
Because one of the things that you argue in this book, you don't use the phrase, I don't think, but you adopt a position which I would equate with the notion of accelerated, the possibility of accelerated evolution.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely.
Do you think that if you were writing this book in 100 years' time, your intuitivist view of human behaviour would have changed? Because actually you'd be talking about a group of human beings who understood their own nature so much better and had built so many things around that, they had become less enthralled to the immediate reactions of the elephant rather
right.
than the conscious reactions
right.
of the rider.
So if we're talking about fast evolution, this is one of the points I make in the book, that in the academic community it was just asserted that there's evolution is slow, there's been no evolution in 50,000 years, because if there has been any substantial evolution, then there could be race differences. And because scientists tend to be very politically liberal and focused around race issues morally, so that idea was just banned. But that's just bollocks up all our thinking about evolution. Genetic evolution is actually quite fast. So Matthew's question is, as I take it, is, well, if evolution is really so fast, what might we evolve to be more rational? And the answer to that is there are two strands of our evolution. There's the genetic and the cultural. The cultural evolution is speeding up radically, and this, I think, is your point. We are living in very different ways even than our grandparents did. The genetic evolution will never stop, but the genetic evolution is driven entirely by the question of who has more than 2.0 children. And until it's the case that only the severely rational, reasoned people have big families and the others don't, that's not going to happen. So the genetic evolution, I think, is not going to be a major force in our future. Things are all messed up in all kinds of ways. Change now is entirely cultural. So it's change in institutions and in culture.
But if, and as many people assert, a core human capability for the 21st century, both in terms of individual success but also in terms of social good, is being able to thrive in diversity, to be able to feel empathy, mm-hmm. Is this something which could feed back into the characteristics that human beings have? Because those are the people who succeed more, even if they're not the people who have the most children. It'll become, as it were, a social norm towards which we all, if we want to succeed in a corporation, mm-hmm. we have to be able to deal with people very different to ourselves.
I see. Yes, I think that is happening. What I call the conservative virtues, which are virtues of loyalty, authority, sanctification, there are a variety of I think of them as conservative strengths. Those are particularly adaptive in times of external threat and intergroup competition. And then there are the more liberal virtues, empathy, tolerance, that thrive in times of peace and prosperity. So the long-term trend, and this is documented in Steve Pinker's book, is exactly this direction that you're laying out. My one caution is that each political group, left or right, whatever your political group is, tends to circle around certain sacred ideas and then be blind to the value of ideas from the other side. So when liberals create institutions, they tend to dismiss the importance of group cohesion, what Durkheim called, his threat was anomy or normlessness. Liberals tend to create very open institutions. They tend to favor mass immigration. And these processes tend to weaken the group solidarity that makes a redistributive welfare state possible. So I do think that liberals can't just charge ahead, be utopian institution designers, because they have a pretty bad record at creating self-sustaining institutions.
I'm kind of asking this question so that you can share with us an important part of the book that you didn't talk about, really, which is that you argue in the book around kind of six fundamental kind of moral intuitions or categories of intuition, and you say that, as it were, conservatives, social conservatives, kind of touch all six of these, and liberals only really touch three of them, and that's one of the reasons why conservatives tend to win political arguments over liberals. I guess I felt you were being a little bit soft on conservatives, simply in the sense that one of the other characteristics of conservatives, whilst holding all these different, responding to all these different moral traditions, is there's a greater scope for contradiction. Mm-hmm. And one of the contradictions that conservatives have got themselves into in Britain and America in the last 15 or 20 years is, on the one hand, the support for social conservatism, as you describe it, and on the other hand, the support for free markets, mm-hmm. On the other. And this is proven to be quite, and this isn't something which you explore in the book. I'm just interested in, that,
yes.
in your reflections.
That's
on
right.
That.
So politics, as we experience it, is coalition building, and politics makes strange bedfellows. It's a phrase we have in America. I imagine you have it here. So in America, we've got this weird paradox that the Republican Party is the home of the Christian right, which wants, at the extreme, almost a form of sort of Christian Sharia. I mean, it wants government to enforce certain values. That's as anti-libertarian as can be. But the Republican Party also includes the libertarians. It's not because they're all conservative. It's because they all hate the welfare state. So they are united by what they see as liberal excess in the 1960s and 70s, liberal hubris in designing all these institutions that, for the social conservatives, rot moral fiber, and to the libertarians, stamp out individual liberty and stamp out negative liberty, replace it with positive liberty. So it's not that conservatism has a contradiction. It's that the conservative wing in both countries combines groups that have different moral foundations.
And you don't see that that leads to inevitable tensions and possibly leads to mm-hmm. politics which is focused on antagonism towards the other because the internal debate is a little bit too painful to have.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's right. But there's a wonderful Arab expression, me against my brother, me and my brother against our cousin, me, my brother, and cousin against the stranger. And right now, the American Republican Party, they are currently engaging in me against my brother. The Republicans are usually much better at hanging together and attacking the liberals. But for the last 3 or 4 months, they've been really going at it with each other. But it's all in terms of who's more socially conservative. As Mitt Romney said, misspeaking, he said, I'm a severe conservative. A bizarre phrase, but he was trying to show, I'm conservative, like social. No, he's not a social conservative at heart, I don't think. But that was an internal debate, and now that he's about to win that, now he'll be moving to the center and being more receptive to some of the libertarian elements. They're going to get it together to fight the Democrats in the fall.
And then finally, we had an event here a few weeks ago where I had a fascinating exchange with philosopher, public intellectual, Alain de Botton, and he'd written a book about religion, how great religion is. But he's not religious. The funny coincidence was that both he and I had the same experience of having going out with a rabbi and saying to the rabbi, we're quite interested in becoming Jewish. Is that possible? And the rabbi explaining that whilst if you're Jewish, you're born Jewish or you become Jewish because of faith. You can then lose your faith and stay Jewish. You can't start. You can't join a religion without having the proper supernatural bit.
That's right.
So I'm interested in what is the relationship between the supernatural and the social in religion? And it, arguably, is it true, is it the case that those of us who like the social bits of religion, or like some of the social bits of religion, are parasites on the people who maintain the supernatural beliefs? Mm-hmm. And you're a classic example. You don't have much time for the supernatural beliefs, but you want the social side.
So, right, that's right.
That, is that a credible, not just for you, but is that a credible position for society?
Well, morality is not really about consistency. We enforce consistency on others. So you're right. I mean, you're right that Jews have a double standard. I was legacied in. I could never get in today, as it were. David Sloan Wilson, he has a long chapter on Judaism. Judaism works very, very effectively, or did in the Middle Ages, certainly, to keep Jews together. I mean, how many tribes mentioned in the Bible are still, you know, the Moabites, the Jebusites, I mean, they're all gone. But Jews, because for 2,000 years, Jewish mothers have been cracking down on their sons who date non-Jewish women, and so there are still Jews today. Now, is this hypocritical? Yeah, of course it is, from a modern liberal perspective. But the broader question you asked was about...
Can religion survive? What I'm saying is, can religion survive without the supernatural belief?
Right.
So more and more people are making arguments for the social value of religion, but in the end, we rely on a group of people who we don't have much sympathy for, who genuinely do have supernatural beliefs to keep the tradition going.
That's right. So my view is that the key innovation for us wasn't supernatural beliefs, it was sacralization. Once we develop the ability to treat things as though they are infinitely valuable and circle around them, that's the key thing. That's what you need for social cohesion. Do you need gods? Not necessarily. So I think that as long as people can sacralize, they can sacralize helping the poor. They can sacralize justice. They can sacralize freedom. As long as you have people able to sacralize things and then be sort of irrational about it, you can get a lot of these social benefits. Now, then you also have the competition and the rivalry. As a social psychologist, the one thing I really want to inject into this conversation, because I imagine this group is mostly on the political left. Let's see, just for curiosity's sake, raise your hand, please, if you would say you are on the political left. Okay, most of you. Raise your hand if you'd say you're on the political right. 1, 2, 3, 4. So this is much more conservative than an American equivalent audience would be. Is there anything else other than left and right? Is it center? Okay, so...
Yeah, well, you're very brave. You're very brave.
Okay.
Oh, the Greens. Yeah, well, I assume the Greens are on the left. People on the left tend to be very wary of groupishness because they equate groupishness with racism. But one of the big findings is that when you divide people up into groups and teams and they have all these identities, you get a big boost on in-group love and trust, and you get only the slightest bump of out-group hate. It's often zero. So like intramural sports, it can be very positive. People love their teammates, but they don't hate the other side. Now, somehow in Britain, you've invented a really toxic form of sport and soccer hooliganism. That's bad news. And now we've got that in the American Congress. But groupishness, you know, so groupishness has to be managed. And there are toxic forms and constructive forms.
Brilliant. Okay. Let's have 1, 2, 3 questions to start.
Dan Sofer, the most fascinating thing I saw in your slides were the data from Sosa's and Bresler. Just extraordinary.
Yes, stunning.
And what it's telling us is for this, you know, for groupish behavior to be effective, we need to ask for sacrifices. It's very interesting because it's not clear to me. And you also talked just a couple of minutes ago about the importance of sacraments. And it's not at all clear to me in our culture that we're making great demands on ourselves, or indeed whether we have any serious sense of sacrament unless we're part of an organized religion. And that says to me that the future is fraught, because unless we can effectively replace what we've had, it seems to me we have a future that's volatile, uncertain, and lacking cohesion. And that concerns me, and you haven't said much about where what you're talking about takes us.
Wonderful question. The answer is yes and no. So yes on the question of do we need to sacralize something to have this stuff work. And this is the one place, I haven't read de Botton's book yet, but I saw his TED talk. I do think he is He proposes that we should have like big restaurants where people come together and do all the religious-y sort of stuff, but it's totally voluntary, no gods, none of that. I don't think that's going to work. I think you do need to have something in common and sacralizing to create a moral community within which people can listen to each other, trust each other. So I think this sort of, you know, religion light it'll give us nice music and architecture maybe, but it's not going to push the buttons in the right way. So on that point, I think you're right. But does that mean that the future is bleak? I don't think so. It does mean that we'll have rising problems of normlessness, anomie, and people seeking answers in psychotherapy and weird New Age movements. And we've had that throughout the late 20th century. Does that mean that our life is bleak? Well, actually, we're killing each other in far smaller numbers. Life is more peaceful. Crime is dropping. Things are getting better in many ways. So in some ways, what's happening is our lives are getting materially better, more peaceful, but a little bit less meaningful. And that's a trade-off that, well, it's up to you, but many people would take. Others would say it's tragic or we're losing a sense of heroism.
I was wondering upon the validity of an atomic model, as a metaphor, if you like, where individuals are like atoms and there's weak bonding, like in the gaseous state, right, between us as we float around, but then there's external forces and we're pushed together, and then there's a kind of like a tipping point, you know, where we suddenly form molecules, if you like, where the nature of bonding changes. I was wondering, well, you know, what is that? You know, how does that happen?
Great, thank you. Yes, metaphors are always risky in case they end up having bad entailments. But in this case, actually, I think the entailments work beautifully. So, of course, atoms don't just drift around in space; they do tend to form molecules. So, imagine that all of the social sciences were studying people as atoms in the gaseous state, and we said that's all there is. There's just gas. That's all there ever is. But that's so obviously wrong. And what I'm trying to say is it's about time we recognize that, in fact, people have these needs for these bonds, and they form these bonds, and they're not just these voluntary bonds that people make. And this, I think, is helpful for understanding the gay marriage debate, in which, of course, gay people want to form these sacralized bonds. They don't just want a civil partnership. Well, at the same time, the religious right, at least in America, and I think you have a bit of it here too, is trying to say, well, marriage is a sacrament, and you can't just go mucking with it for liberal political reasons. So I think both sides are really groping for how can we really, we want these stronger bonds. How can we get them and keep them?
Thank you. Brilliant talk. My name's Andrew. I'm a fellow of the RSA, and I'm a consultant in collaboration and innovation. And I'm particularly interested in your thoughts as it relates to business.
Oh, yeah.
In particular, there's some recent stuff like Suzanne Cain, who spoke here recently, talks about the need for introvert and quiet behavior. Mm-hmm. And also, at the same time, you have people like Forrester Research saying that the biggest block to innovation and creativity is a lack of collaboration. Which, of course, requires a group process. So what's your take on what you've been talking about today as it relates to innovation and in a business and collaboration, et cetera?
Thank you. That is a fabulous question. It takes me to where I want to go next in my research. I'm working now in a business school, and business is only possible because we have this hivish, groupish mentality. In fact, I often put up a definition of a corporation from English corporate law in the 1700s, and it basically, you know, you guys, well, I guess the Dutch came up with it first, and then they boomed in terms of wealth, and you guys said, oh, well, you know, we're almost ready for that too, and then you did it too. But corporate law basically is a legal framework in which individuals can become a superorganism. It's legally considered an entity, a creature. Corporation means body. The business world, I think, desperately needs to understand this new hivish perspective on human nature. They already are experts on it. But there are often business consultants, there are leadership styles of transactional leadership in which you treat people as atoms and you give them good stuff and that makes them want to do good stuff for you. There's so much more. Eleanor Ostrom won the Nobel Prize in 2009 for her work on how small groups manage limited, scarce resource, you know, water rights, fishing rights, things like that. And these are two slides from David Sloan Wilson himself. He gave a talk at NYU, and I asked him for these slides. But this is what I want to show you. Ostrom's principles make so much sense from a multi-level selection perspective. Here they are. Here's how you make small groups work. You need a strong group identity and purpose. And so issues like, you know, having group pride, corporate culture, and even at the national scale, I would say a sense of patriotism is generally a good thing, which is often doubted on the left. Proportional equivalence of costs and benefits, that just means fairness. Are people getting out in proportion to what they're putting in? Consensual decision-making. Monitoring. You must have monitoring. If you have free riders, you've got to catch them quickly. Otherwise, it makes the whole thing decay. So anyway, the point is, there are a lot of principles that fall out of a multi-level selection framework for how do you get groups to really suppress free riding and really give it their all and love it. That's the amazing thing to me about business, that people aren't just in it for the money. I mean, in many occupations they are. But in the best companies, the best places to work for, they feel they're doing something larger. I've done some consulting for Zappos.com, and they feel they don't even act like they care much about shoes. They don't really know that. I mean, they didn't start. What they think of themselves as doing is delivering happiness. So it's possible to have a higher sense of purpose in the business world, and the best companies do that.
Hi, I love what you're doing, and I'm struggling with the concept of sacralization. How can you? I understand intellectually how it's necessary and how it would be great. But can you do that without real reference point to the sacred, whatever that is? Mm-hmm.
Yes. So sacralization, as I said, I focus not so much on supernatural entities, but on sacralization. So I myself am an atheist. My last trip to London, I went to Westminster Abbey, and Charles Darwin, I believe, is buried there. Is that true? When there's an actual, you know, thing on the ground, does that mean that the body is under that? Okay. So there,
not always, but I think in this case, yes.
Okay. So so I'm there. It's like a pilgrimage for me because Darwin gave me such enlightenment. And British people and tourists are just walking over his grave, and I'm horrified. Now, obviously, he doesn't get hurt. There's nothing practical here. But symbolically, I greatly value Darwin. And I feel that way about my country. I feel that way about sacred sites. There's no supernatural needed. But to the extent that you have an identity as a scientist, as an evolutionist, as an American, as a Brit, whatever it is, you have the capacity to hold certain things sacred. And I think this helps. As I said, there are many benefits to group cohesion that are not paid for by out-group hatred. This is an issue we've had in America for such a long time. You have it too here about immigration law. I'm very lucky that America accepted vast boats full of immigrants around the turn of the last century. My ancestors made it out of Russia and Poland. But there were too many immigrants sociologically for America to absorb, and they slammed the gate. There was a long period of assimilation, and it really enriched American culture in the long run. But in the short run, so much immigration weakens people's sense that we are one, weakens people's sense of common norms. So I think you need to manage immigration policy carefully. And patriotism, the idea of assimilating and having immigrants take part in this shared sacralization, I think this is very healthy. You don't need gods. There's nothing supernatural. Just love of country, love of principle, love of heroes, that sort of thing.
Scott Atran has a nice definition of the sacred, which came out of his work in the Middle East, in which he said that, I think one of his definitions is that the sacred is something which, if you were offered money to abandon it, you would believe it even more, rather than be inclined to believe it less.
That's right. That's why it's so psychologically interesting. It's not rational.
And the opposite of utilitarianism, absolutely. So look, what we're going to do is we've got 4 minutes. We're going to take three questions, which mustn't be more than 30 seconds long. And then Jonathan's going to answer them all in 2 minutes, because what he can do. All right, so we'll take one here. We'll take one here, and I have to take one from the Liberal Democrat, or else you'd accuse me of political bias.
Hi. David Lightman, I'm a fellow here. I'm just interested in how the book changed your thinking at all, and specifically, as well as on the big level, specifically in terms of your approach to religion, if any.
Hi, Francesca Alston. My question is, what do you think are the most important and useful lessons from your work, in particular in the political arena?
Very good. And then finally, friendless friend. No, that's not true.
Samuel Bowles has done a lot of work in showing how reciprocal altruism in small groups can aid what you would call group selection in hunter-gatherer communities in our prehistory. I'm just wondering, I feel very uncomfortable with multi-level selection. I still feel uncomfortable after you finish talking. Surely, if Hamilton's rule works to engage costly signalling to ensure group cohesion, it's still a decision taken by an individual. It's still individual selection. It's not multi-level selection. And that puts at risk a lot of what else you're saying.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Brilliant. So three fantastic questions. Okay. Your own, the effect of the book on your own views. What's the most important lesson? And I understand that question. Not everyone understands that question, but you'll have to explain the question and the answer.
So I'll take this one first so I can end on a more inspiring note, which is most of selection is individual level. All I'm trying to argue is that it's not all. There are some features that I think came down to us by group level. That's all I'm trying to say. In terms of how the book affected me, I started this work as a partisan liberal, upset that the Democrats kept saying stupid things and alienating most Americans. And while writing the book and trying to, and spending years trying to explain to liberal audiences that conservatives are not crazy, that they are acting on moral intuitions that are not bad, I actually came to believe it, to the point where now I am not a conservative, but I think of it as yin-yang. That is, liberals see certain kinds of threats and victims, conservatives see certain kinds of threats and the need for competitiveness. And if you let either group run everything, they're going to screw it up because they're going to circle around their sacred values and ignore, they're going to go too far. So we really need both sides. And in terms of what is the most important lesson, the single most important lesson is moral humility. That is, the very nature of our moral thinking is to make a circle around sacred objects and values with our team, and then we all work together to construct reasons for why they're so stupid and evil, and we are absolutely right. And we're all wrong about that. So what I'm hoping my book will do is help people see, really, it's the Jesus quote about first take the speck out of your own eye, and then you can criticize that in your neighbor. If we have a little bit of moral humility, a little bit of an appreciation for how both sides, all sides are right about something, not everything, but they're right about something, then I think we can get along a lot better and reduce, at least in America, we have such terrible problems with polarization, reduce our disagreements from sort of angry, nasty demonization to more productive forms of disagreement that end up producing rational outcomes and effective outcomes. So that's it.
So Jonathan, thanks for that. When you were answering the second question, I was rather reminded of that quote, which says that if you're not left-wing when you're young, you have no heart. If you're not right when you're old, you have no head. But given that we have here a mature, progressive and intelligent audience, it's not necessary that that is the course that your life takes. It's been a fantastic conversation. I would really, really strongly recommend this book. It's incredibly readable. It's incredibly comprehensive. It's also very scholarly. You'll learn an enormous amount from it. But before you get the book and before Jonathan signs it, it just remains for me to ask you to join me in thanking Jonathan Haidt.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, therSA.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.